Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vannelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the persons appearing on the program.
Today on Rainbow Country, queer progress from homophobia to homo nationalism. That and so much more. Stay tuned for Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Harder, porn star, burlesque performer, and the creator of Porn to Be a Star. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello and welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. As always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, did you know that Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto? The sound of your city. And now proudly in syndication on 10 outlets across Canada as of June 1st. From the Yukon to the prairies, to the east coast of Canada in the Maritimes, to Ontario's cottage country, southern Ontario, even down to Buffalo, New York, and online. And thanks to you, tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Together, we have built Rainbow Country into a nationally syndicated gay radio show, a number one LGBT podcast, and a top 100 LGBT podcast to follow, currently sitting at number 42 on Feedspot.com. And last week, Rainbow Country was number 2 on Podomatic's gay and lesbian chart. So, this is June 2021, Gay Pride Month. Over the past 5 years of Rainbow Country, I've had on pillars of Canada's LGBT community, everyday voices from the community, Oscar winners, Grammy winners, Juno winners, best-selling authors, and everything in between. And they have all chosen to come onto this little gay radio show to share their stories with us. And for that, I could not be more proud of what we together have accomplished. Working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond, honey. That is what it's all about. So with all that being said, this is the launch of Season 6 of Rainbow Country. So on this episode, episode 252, today, he is the founder of AIDS Action Now, a former member of Canada's iconic gay liberation journal, The Body Politic, a recipient of the City of Toronto's Award of Merit for his human rights work, activist, historian, author, Tim McCaskill. He'll join me in conversation to talk about his 2016 book, Queer Progress, what happened on the night of the bathhouse raids on February 5th, 1981, and the pivotal part that he played. We'll talk about all that and so much more. Plus music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. And on this episode, I'll be featuring Canadian Disco, Classic, Culture Club, two acts from the LGBT community, UK group you may or may not have heard of as of yet, Alphas, and indie folk artist, Evan Westfall. So my friends, this journey through Rainbow Country begins right after this.
Hi, I'm Saida Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara. Rainbow Country,
Up next, activist, historian, and the author of Queer Progress, Tim McCaskill. Tim McCaskill, hi, how are you?
I am well. How are you?
I am well. I am better now that I am speaking to you. Thank you very much for being here to have your voice, your story be heard by the LGBT community and beyond, Tim McCaskill. So let's start here with yourself. You are, among other things, you are an author. You have two books, I believe, under your belt.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Let's start with Queer Progress, From Homophobia to Homo Nationalism. On Amazon, your book has a rating of 4.8 out of 5 stars. Some customer reviews say how one man helped change hearts and minds. Another, a fascinating read. And the last one I'll spotlight simply says illuminating. Queer Progress, From Homophobia to Homo Nationalism. First of all, my first question, what is this book about? Talk to me about what this book is encompassing.
I guess it is about a history of the gay movement, focusing on Toronto from the 70s, so shortly after decriminalization, to 2014, which was World Pride that was held in Toronto. So it seemed to be to have a kind of an arc from a point that we were all criminals to the point that we were being celebrated as a community, both in Canada and around the world. What I was trying to look at was both how the movement had changed over that 40 years from a notion of kind of gay liberation and social transformation to one of, in fact, being included in society rather than transforming society, and how society had changed at the same time from one that was relatively socially equal. If you look at kind of the Holchansky study, you'll see that in Toronto anyway, in 1976, 6% of people are in a kind of middle income areas. And then I think there's 19% poor or below that and 15% above that. When you go to 2005, which is sort of the end of his study, which is the year that gay marriage was finally adopted, about more than 50% of Toronto's population is in the below average income area. The middle income has shrunk to 20-some percent, and the rich has remained about the same. So what we see is polarized society. And so one of the things that I was trying to make sense of was how we shifted from a society that was socially equal, but in terms of queer people, legally really unequal, like we were criminals, to a society where we are legally equal, but one that is much more socially unequal, that then produces all of these divisions within our community. So that was the kind of stuff that I was trying to sort out.
So in a nutshell, this goes from the 70s to what, 2014?
2014, that's right.
The book, Queer Progress. In a nutshell, how do you think the LGBT community has progressed from the 70s to now in 2021, let's say? How do you see it?
Well, I mean, certainly in terms of our position in society, it has changed dramatically. I guess I grew up in a really homophobic society, right? A society where it was illegal to have gay sex, where the only words that would apply to us were, well, in my school, in elementary school, it was sissy, and then a little later on, it became queer. There was one really effeminate boy in my school career. I grew up in a small town, a village, actually. So we went to school with the same cohort of kids from elementary school right through the end of high school. And this kid was gender nonconforming, I guess one would say today, and he was harassed and teased and beaten up and isolated and made fun of, and his life was hell. I mean, that was the kind of situation for anybody who was anywhere approaching queerness, approaching not being part of gender norms. And now we live in a society where, you know, school boards participate in the pride parade, people can get married, all of those kinds of things have meant that we as a group are much more integrated and included into society. But as a group, we've also become much more divided, I think. When, like, the 1970s, when I came out, if you look at those studies, if 66% of people in Toronto were middle income, that would probably mean that that was true, too, of the vast majority of people in the gay community. So what that meant was, you know, everybody could afford to go to a bar or to a bath, or most people could, right? And if you were poor, you could probably still scrape together enough money to do that. And if you were rich, there was no place else to go because you weren't so rich you could fly off to some exotic locale, right? So it produced this kind of common, we were all on a common boat. We were all kind of despised by society, and you know, we all had a certain amount of dispensable income, difference between men and women. I mean, that's something else we need to talk about. But more or less, we were all in the same boat. Whereas now that we're supposedly all accepted, we live in really different worlds depending on what part of the city we live in. You can see that. I mean, the kerfuffle around Pride with Black Lives Matter in 2016, I think, made that really quite clear that, you know, for kind of more middle class, probably white, gay men living in the center of the city, many of them see the police as people who protect their property, right? If you're black and living in Etobicoke or Scarborough, you know, you see the police as somebody who harasses you and cards you and, you know, sometimes shoots you, right? And so, like, why would you invite them to our party, right? And we have a very different, because of our different, the different worlds we live in now, people have developed very different relationships to the state, to the government, to all of those kinds of things. And that produces a much more fragmented community, I think.
Homo nationalism? Mm. What is that? What does that mean?
Okay, I guess it's kind of the opposite of institutional homophobia. And we talked about the kind of world that I grew up in when gay sex was illegal. I can remember when the debate was going on around decriminalization. There was a kind of an edgy public affairs show called This Hour Has 7 Days. It came on late on Sunday night. And as part of the debate, they actually interviewed a homosexual, probably the first homosexual, you know, knowingly on any kind of CBC program. And I remember watching it, right? And this guy was backlit. So you couldn't see the face, you just saw a silhouette. And his voice was distorted so you wouldn't be able to recognize the voice. That was the only image that CBC could show of a gay person, right? It was like so shameful, so, you know, out of the kind of possibilities of polite society. That,
and when was this? You know, what year?
That would be 1968.
Okay.
Right? And I was kind of in high school, later on in high school. So homo nationalism is the opposite of that. That's when the state begins to embrace you and actually begins to use you to give itself an alibi, you know. So now Canada, like, scolds other places that are not as tolerant as Canada is on gay rights, right? And we become this kind of poster boy for how liberal and progressive Canada is. Yet Canada is still the same kind of colonial and racist society that it always was, right? That none of that has gone away. And in fact, in terms of social disparity and poverty, we've gotten a lot worse than we were in the 70s. And so gay rights becomes this flag that Canada gets to fly to show how good it is, when in fact it hasn't really changed that much for a whole lot of people, including people in our community who don't happen to be white and don't happen to be middle class. Mm.
So let's talk about the 80s. Mm. Oh, the 80s. More so February 5th, 1981. Operation Perfect. Soap. That was the name given to the police raid that targeted 4 gay bathhouses in Toronto, the Barracks, Club Toronto, Richmond Street Health Emporium, Roman II Health and Recreation Spa. You gotta love some of these names.
Yeah, yeah.
Some 300 men were arrested. Did you help to organize the very first protest march that happened at Yonge and Wellesley?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was there. I was involved in all the famous one and all the ones that followed that, right? That we had to face.
How did you get involved in that, in organizing that, helping to organize that?
So when I came out in 1974, and I joined shortly afterwards the Collective of the Body Politic, which was kind of the iconic gay liberation paper in Canada, certainly in Toronto in Canada, and it had a certain international reach as well. So I'd been writing for the Body Politic and was involved in the collective for, I guess at that point, 7 or 8 years up until 1981. So the story is, I have a very spotty academic career. It took me 13 years to get through a three-year general BA. And so in 1981, I had gone back in one of my periodic returns to university to try to get some more credits to finish this BA. And the night of February 5th, 81, I had stayed home to cram for an economics exam the next morning. It was a economics 101 course, which I think they failed about 60% of people went into it. It was one of these courses that they used to screen out people from the more advanced economics courses. It's all dancing graphs. You know, you change the price of potatoes and what happens to the price of socks, that kind of stuff. Very mathematical. Not my strongest suit. And so anyway, I was cramming for this exam, went to bed early because the exam was 9 o'clock the next morning. And I was just drifting off to sleep when one of my roommates knocked on the door and said, Gerald Hannon from the Body Politic is on the phone, wants to talk to you. And I said, well, I'm half asleep. Like, I'll talk to him tomorrow, right? There's no, what can be the rush? And he said, no, he said, it's an emergency. He's got to talk to you right now. And so I was grumpy, dragged myself out of bed, went down to the phone. And Gerald said, they're raiding all the baths. You're closest to the Club Toronto. Get over there and find out what's going on and talk to people. And so I'm not a very happy camper, but, you know, it sounded like this was important. And so pulled on some clothes. It's February. It's a cold, windy February night. And going to cross Allen Gardens over to where the club baths are at Mutual and Carlton. And I remember like turning the corner to the club baths. And the place was full of cops, right? And the image that came to my mind was like one of those nature programs where the Pride of Lions is just, you know, made its big kill and they're all sitting around looking very satisfied with themselves, right? So they didn't pay any attention to me at all, right? Paddy wagons were there and they were letting some people out on their own reconnaissance. You know, they'd given them pieces of paper to, you know, appear in court on such and such a date. And so I started trying to interview people. And I think one of the first people that came out was this middle-aged guy. You know, like not your fashionable downtown gay guy. Like he was dressed in kind of regular middle-aged clothes. And when he started to speak, he had this Portuguese accent. So he's like an ordinary working-class Portuguese guy. And so I said, what's going on in there? And he said, I don't understand it at all, right? This is a cheap place I can spend the night. It's like much cheaper than a hotel. And all of a sudden I was in my room and, you know, these policemen like kicked down the door and they dragged me out and now I have to appear in court. And then he kind of looked at me and said like, oh, like, who the hell are you? Right? Why am I telling you all this stuff, right? And I said, you know, I'm from the Body Politic, the gay paper. And he said, you're gay. And I said, yeah. And he said, I mean, he changed. He said, like, why are they doing this to us? We've been going to these places for years. They've got no right to do this stuff, right? And then he said, and what does this paper that they've given me mean? Does I have to go to court? Is my name going to appear in the papers, right? And, like, at this point, you know, you could hear, like, almost tears in his voice. Like, this guy is terrified. He's probably in the closet, maybe got a family, right? And he's going to be outed in the press. Like, his life is about to be completely disrupted, right? You know, so I kind of said, I don't know. We'll certainly try to prevent anybody's name from appearing in the paper. But at this point, who knows what's going on, right? Because nobody really knows. So I kind of continued interviewing. And I mean, it's kind of a funny story. I was still kind of numb, I guess, from being out in the cold and, you know, being half asleep before I got there. And then they started bringing out the guys that they weren't releasing on their own reconnaissance. You know, they didn't have enough ID, or they'd been too mouthy, or God knows what, right? And these two big cops came out the door of the club, and between them there was this absolutely gorgeous young man, just like, you know, oh God, to die for. And you know, you step out of this hot bath into the cold night air, and everybody kind of pauses, right? And so there he is, like, if this cinematic pause caught in the streetlights between these two cops. And all of a sudden, I just found myself enraged. You know, like, how can they do this to this gorgeous young man? How can they do this to us, right? It was kind of all mixed up, right? As you know, lust and politics often gets mixed up. And so, you know, I stayed around another couple of hours, kind of interviewing people as they came out, getting madder and madder, and went home, couldn't sleep. And needless to say, my exam the next morning at 9 o'clock was not my best effort ever. And as soon as it was finished, I jumped on my bicycle, because I'm a, you know, avid bicycle rider, even though it's February, and raced down to the body politic office where a meeting was being held to try to figure out, like, what the hell we were supposed to do. By this time, we'd realized that there were like nearly 300 people arrested, and, you know, all this stuff was coming out. And they'd also, you know, done enormous amount of damage to the premises. Like, they hadn't like knocked on people's doors. They'd kicked people's doors down. They didn't ask. People had offered them their keys to their locker. And police had brought crowbars, and they pried open the lockers instead. They threw furniture in the pool at Richmond Street. It was the only one that actually had a pool. And ruined the furniture and fucked up the pool and, you know, the whole thing. And they just trashed the places, and, you know, homophobic screaming at people, and, you know, the whole thing, right? So people were really angry. So I raced down to this meeting, and it's just coming to a close. I asked her, like, what are we going to do? And Chris Birchall, who was this feisty young dyke on the Body Politic Collective, said, we're doing a demonstration tonight at midnight at Young & Wellesley. And I said, you've got to be out of your mind, right? Guys, this is the days before, there's no internet, there's no email, there's no social media. I mean, if you want to organize a demonstration, you've got to print posters and put them up and talk to people and phone them. It takes like weeks to get people to come out to anything, right? And so the idea of trying to organize a demonstration that very night seemed to be crazy, A. B, this is night on a Friday night on Yonge Street. Yonge Street on a Friday night is, you know, is dangerous territory. That's where all the straight bars are. That's where the boys that come to Queer Bash all are. You try to avoid Yonge Street as much as you possibly can. And to, like, come out there at midnight and do a demonstration, I mean, it seemed to me to be completely crazy. And Chris said to me, look, it's in all the newspapers. It's the front page news, front page of the Toronto Star, the raid. Everybody knows about it because they've arrested so many people. Everybody's already talked to all their friends. We've got posters being made right now to tell people where and when to come. And we're going to be sending people around to all the bars on the Friday night, and the bars are going to be full to tell people what's going on. And so, yes, we're having this tonight. And by the way, you're part of the marshalling team. You've got to organize things and keep people, you know, safe and together and all that kind of stuff. I thought, oh my God. And I remember walking over thinking, I wonder if we're going to get killed tonight, you know, because if there are only 30 or 40 people. And, you know, if the police don't get us, the queer bashers will. And so I was really kind of, you know, I'll do my duty, but this seemed to me to be a really crazy thing to do. And got to Young & Wellesley about 11:30, and there were already 30 or 40 people there at this point. Sound system hadn't arrived. Of course, all those screw-ups were bound to happen. But I pulled together the marshalling team. We figured out what we were going to do. We didn't know what we were going to do with this demonstration, by the way. You know, we knew we were gathering, and some people thought we should march down to 52 Division, which is where the raids had been organized out of.
Fuck you, 52.
Fuck you, 52. Down at Dundas, west of University, west of University. Others thought maybe we should go to police headquarters, which in those days was much closer. It was up on Jarvis Street. And would have been much safer, too, because we'd be marching north from Wellesley and then along Bloor and then to Jarvis, which is sort of away from straight world Yonge Street. But anyway, by 11:45, all of a sudden, there was like more and more people arriving. And we had people going out to all the bars saying, like, out of the bars, into the streets. And people were, who normally just ignored us, ignored the activists, were all really pissed off and all started coming out. And so by midnight, suddenly this crowd on the street was so big that it spilled off the sidewalks. And the next thing we knew, we were blocking Yonge Street. Now, that doesn't signify a whole lot for people today, I suppose. But in those days, Yonge Street, longest street in the world, Canada's most famous street, all of this stuff, the police never let Yonge Street close. That was kind of like the rule book. You couldn't get a parade permit for Yonge Street. The only thing that was ever allowed to close down Yonge Street was the Santa Claus parade once a year. And suddenly we were blocking this iconic street. And, there were a few cops around because they hadn't expected that we would be able to organize anything on such short notice either. Certainly nothing of this size. So they hadn't sent anybody. And then the crowd sort of took on a life of its own. So there were speeches and things, and we had to figure out what in the world we were going to do with them, because these people are 3,000 people, really angry. Fuck you, 52, no more shit. Everybody blowing their whistles and the street blocked. So we were trying to figure out whether we should go north or south, and then the crowd kind of decided on its own. Fuck you, 52 was the slogan that carried the day, and suddenly people started marching south, and we took over Yonge Street and marched all the way south, quickly. There were people guys spilling out of the straight bars, but we were such a big and angry crowd. Nobody really wanted to mess with us. There was one incident sort of halfway down Young where some guy started shouting homophobic shit, and a group of the demonstrators kind of cornered him in a doorway, and it looked like they were going to kill him. And then the police suddenly appeared, and they got cornered in the doorway too, protecting the straight guy. Luckily, we had a marshalling team that was strong enough that we were able to move people along and get them out of there. At one point, the cops put a car across Yonge Street to try to block it. Smart. And people just flowed over the car, right?
And was this the march that also had some undercover cops in it?
No, that's the next one. That's the one that happened 2 weeks later. Okay. This one, the cops didn't know.
This would have been on the 6th.
This was on the 6th. This is
the day after.
Yeah, Friday the 6th. The other one was 2 weeks later. And then, we were better organized, but also the cops were better organized. And mm-hmm. so that pushed it to a completely different level. Anyway, we got to Dundas, turned right to go along Dundas. Streetcar was coming along. Streetcars figure, we've got the right of way, right? And so we just tried ringing its bell, moving forward, and people started pounding on the streetcar until one of the windows broke. And then the streetcar driver realized probably it was better to stop, and stopped and let the crowd sort of flow on past. There were a group of young queer bashers who decided they were going to defend the police and put a line of guys across Dundas at University, striking karate poses and looking really good, right? But 3,000 people coming at you at a clip, right? These guys kind of took one look at it and then scattered, right? And then we were at 52 Division, and the cops had set up a line of cops to try to protect the police station, because, it looked like we were going to burn it down or something. And so there was this incredible standoff with people right nose to nose with the cops, screaming at them, and the cops kind of looking scared shitless, but also not knowing what to do. And remember, we as the marshals, this is all unplanned, right? We hadn't expected to be there. We didn't know what to do either. And it looked like it would be, I mean, something was going to happen. And so at a certain point, somebody was going to throw a punch and all hell was going to break loose. And then luckily somebody said Queen's Park. Some people started shouting Queen's Park because a raid this size, I mean, there were like hundreds of officers involved in it. I mean, it's not something that was going to be planned at one small police station, right? I mean, it had to have approval from somewhere higher up. And it was a conservative government in the province at that time. And an election was in the wings. And so it really smelled like this was a gambit by the conservative government to show that it was strong on law and order and would put the queers in their place, that kind of stuff, for the election. Anyway, so the crowd turned and started going up University. We're like probably 1, maybe 1:30, maybe 2 in the morning, right? And people started moving faster and faster up University. Now, in a demonstration like that, the most dangerous place for demonstrators is at the back of the demonstration, because that's where people kind of lag behind, and you know, your back is to what's behind you. At the front, like, nothing's going to stop you. But at the back, that's where you need your marshalling team. So I pulled the marshals around to the back to defend the back of the demonstration. And by this point, the queer bashers from before had kind of gathered, and they were kind of following us and shouting stuff. And so we needed to keep a distance between them and the crowd, because we didn't want anybody to get hurt. By the time I got to Queen's Park, I could see at the front, because I was at the very back, the front, people were throwing themselves against those big wooden doors at Queen's Park. And there was, you know, somehow or other, a TV camera had arrived. And so this was all, once again, very cinematically lit, right? So you could see the bright lights and people throwing themselves. You could see the doors beginning to kind of vibrate. And I thought, my God, now we're going to burn down Queen's Park, right? But at this point, cops arrived, like a whole bevy of cops arrived with truncheons, and they beat people back down off the steps of Queen's Park, right? So then there was another kind of standoff there. So by this point, though, it's getting late, right? And it's cold. And so you can see the energy beginning to dissipate. So we spent probably another hour trying to get people in small groups back to Church Street or back to where they could catch a bus away, because once again, if a demonstration breaks up and the police are around and they're really pissed, or the queer bashers are around, that's when people are going to get attacked. That's when they're going to get hurt. And so, you know, I think I didn't get home that night till like 4 or 5 in the morning by the time we managed to get most people away safely.
How many marches, protest marches, were there because of that during that time?
Okay, so there was that one, then there was the one 2 weeks later. Different elements came together. There was another raid in Edmonton, so there was one on that. There was probably 5 or 6, with the last of the major ones being in June of that year, and that's the one where it turned into a real riot. We got attacked by the police. You know, I got my head bashed in. People got hit by cars. I got taken to emergency at Wellesley, and the place was full of people with cuts and bruises and broken bones from that altercation with the police. So it was, you know, a very hot spring and early summer.
And on that note, we will return after this Rainbow Country update. His name is Ray. To some, he may be just another panhandler on Toronto's Lakeshore Boulevard. But the drug-addicted homeless man has a backstory straight from the sea and lost to the streets. This new Canadian documentary is from the director Michael Del Monte, who brought us the 2018 trans film Transformer, and in 2019, Village of the Missing. His name is Ray is currently free to Hot Doc members across Canada and has been extended until June 24th. For more information, hotdocs.ca. Strike a pose the 2016 documentary that reunites the male dancers of Madonna's Blonde Ambition tour, is being re-released in conjunction with the 30th anniversary of Madonna, Truth or Dare. Strike a Pose will be re-released virtually on May 21st through Film Movement. For more information, filmmovement.com and search Strike a Pose. The 30th annual LGBT Film Festival Inside Out runs May 27th to June 6th, virtually. A couple of films that are part of this year's festivals are Trans in Trumpland and Bloodthirsty. Both of those projects have been featured right here on this very program. Inside Out runs May 27th to June 6th. For more information, insideout.ca. And just a bit of a heads up, Inside Out is streaming virtually, but only available in Ontario. During all this time, you are part of the body politic. You were just saying, you know, now it's an iconic gay liberation journal. Back then it was. And you were part of that from what, 74 to 86, I believe?
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. First of all, what led you to become part of the body politic, this iconic gay newspaper?
So when I came out in 74, it was like a huge step for me growing up in this small town. Like I went to a gay pride march in 1974, which I read about in the Body Politic, which I'd been buying on the sly. I'd been living in South America for a couple of years. So I'd come back to Canada and I figured, look, I've either got to jump off a bridge and come out or come out, right? I can't go on like this, right? And so I went to that pride and somebody picked me up and took me home and had sex with me and gave me a bunch of gay liberation books and told me to come back for more when I finished reading. And so I read very quickly. At that point, there weren't very many organizations in Toronto. So there was the Body Politic with one. There's the Gay Alliance Towards Equality, which had just formed, which is more of a civil rights organization. And there was CHAT, the Community Homophile Association, which ran a kind of a, you know, had a hotline and did education work and counseling. And it was like a much more conservative organization, kind of that old homophile way of doing things, old homophile paradigm. And so I had written for Guerrilla newspaper back in the 70s before I went to South America. Guerrilla was the kind of the counterculture lefty magazine in Toronto. And so I knew a little bit about journalism. So when I came out and wanted to like contribute, the Body Politic seemed to be the place to go, you know, because then I could use the kind of skills that I had developed. I could, you know, I could write, I could edit and do that kind of thing. And also they were kind of, it was kind of the intellectual focus of the community. I mean, these guys were, I mean, I found them like intimidating and smart and, you know, they knew all this stuff that I didn't know because they'd been out for like 2 or 3 years, my Lord, right? They were like elders, right? And it became this university for me, university in gay liberation, I guess, so that I could contribute, but also learn.
And how many people were part of the Body Politic?
That changes over the years. We're probably about mostly 10, maybe 10 or 15 people on the collective, which was the center. But then there were groups of, then there were volunteers that also contributed. So the collective were the ones that set the editorial direction, like actually pulled things together, made sure that the layout was done and there were no spelling errors and all of that kind of stuff, did that kind of real grunt work. And then there were other groups that would maybe help with classified ads or help with distribution or, you know, do a particular kind of task on a regular basis, but didn't have the responsibility for directing the whole paper.
And it was a big newspaper. It was folded in half or something. So it looked like, you know, kind of like a smaller magazine, but it opened up.
Yeah, yeah.
It unfolded.
Yeah, and it had like 30 or 40 pages, you know, mm-hmm. at its height. And We sold about a third of our copies in Toronto, another third was the rest of Canada, and a third was international. So we were kind of one of the leading gay media outlets in the world at that time.
Okay, so July 1977, Emmanuel Jack, a 12-year-old boy who's a shoeshine boy.
14, I think, but anyway.
He was murdered by a group of men.
Yeah.
This was July 1977.
That's correct, yeah.
December 1977, the Body Politic runs an article called Men Loving Boys Loving Men. And I guess this sort of, you know, didn't sit well with the police. And I don't know if this is when raids started happening on the Body Politic when it comes to the police, or if it was happening beforehand, or if this triggered it. But you guys were raided and arrested, and in, what was it, like 82, you guys were eventually acquitted?
So 82 was the second raid, so we were all arrested again that time. And then 83, we were finally all acquitted.
Those days must have been heady days for you.
Yeah.
What was it like to be part of that environment? Did you feel safe? Did you feel you always had to look over your shoulder?
No, one didn't feel, I mean, one never felt safe, right, as a gay man in Toronto. Like one of the, taking us back even earlier, one of the first pieces of lore that I learned was the Cherry Beach Express. And that was when if you're coming out of a bar or someplace late at night, you needed to be very careful, because if the police saw you and figured you were a gay man, what they would do would be to pick you up and take you down to Cherry Beach, which was, you know, in those days there was no public transit or anything there in the middle of the night, sort of the middle of nowhere, and they would beat you up and leave you there. Right. So, you know, you always had to have your wits about you as a gay man in those days, right? You never felt safe. So, but back to 77, I wasn't actually here for the discussion on Men Loving Boys Loving Men, which was Gerald Hennen's article. I'd been in Africa and came back in November 77, just after the article had been published, and sort of retook up my duties on the collective. It was quiet at first. The article was probably ill thought out, but an attempt at responding to some of the kinds of homophobia that had been produced by the Jack's murder. The way that the homophobia was organized was that homosexuals were pedophiles who killed children, right? And therefore, why have we decriminalized them? They should all be in jail. There should be a death penalty for homosexuality, all of this kind of stuff. And so the Body Politic, which was bold, said, look, we've got to dismantle some of that quote unquote logic. The paper had always taken a stand to say that children had the right to sexuality. And so Gerald wrote this article with a bunch of men who had sex with much younger guys, I guess you would call children, to try to show that child-adult relationships were not necessarily murderous or any of these kinds of things, and trying to humanize it. Right now, that probably, given the really feverish atmosphere of the time, was not the best strategy. But anyway, the article was published. Like 3 weeks went by, and there was no response at all. And then the Toronto Sun somehow got wind of it and started freaking out. And then on the night of the 30th, I think it was, the first raid happened, and I was actually in the office
at the Body Politic,
mm-hmm. Working late, because I'd been assigned my new job after I came back was to do international news, which meant that I had to read all of the lesbian and gay newspapers from around the world every month, and then produce these kinds of news synopses of what was happening in different parts of the world. So I was at the back of the office, kind of reading this stack of papers, and Ed Jackson was at the front. And all of a sudden, in through the elevator doors comes this gang of cops and said, we've got a search warrant. And then they started tearing everything apart. And we didn't really know what to do because they didn't say we could go. I mean, we couldn't go because we had to be there to kind of witness what was going on and make sure they didn't really trash the place. We did manage to get a phone call two phone calls. One was to the rest of the collective, which had happened to be at a party on Toronto Island at the time, because Jonathan Katz was in town. He just published that first major volume of queer history in the States. And so he was there, and they were sort of at this meeting with him. And we phoned them to say, don't come back to the office because the police are here and we don't know whether we're all going to be arrested or not, right? The two of us who were here. And then we managed to phone the lawyer. And the lawyer tried to negotiate with the police and saying, tell us what you want. And, you know, they'll give you whatever files and things you want. And the police said, no, we got a search warrant. And they ended up taking, I think it was 12 packing boxes away. All of our files are subscription lists, you know, all sorts of stuff, right? It was basically an attempt to close down the operation. And so stayed there. And then they finally left, taking all of their stuff, leaving us with this ransacked office and not quite knowing what to do next.
Do you think that the fallout from what happened in 77 in part played into what happened in 81 and the bathhouse raids?
No, I think that that's probably the wrong way of looking at it. Remember, decriminalization happened in 69 and the police were not happy about that. They didn't like that at all. The police actually went to Parliament and testified saying, you know, we can't do this. It'll be like allowing criminals to engage in criminal activity and da 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 da. So the police had never, ever liked the fact that there was a growing gay community in Toronto, right? Never. And so when the Body Politic, you know, did this kind of provocative thing around intergenerational sex, I mean, that was an excuse. And that wasn't the first time the police had actually come around. They'd never actually arrested people before, but there'd been other articles earlier on that they'd taken objection to. One, we had to recall a whole issue of the paper because they said that they were going to charge us. And, you know, at that point, the paper was still relatively young and didn't feel it could withstand that. Another point, they just kind of, you know, made us take a copy out of the front window. At that point, we had a little office on Carlton Street, which had a, you know, a front window that we could display things in. What touched off the 81 raids was the 1980 election, municipal election. John Sewell, who'd been the mayor of Toronto, had actually spoken out in defense of the Body Politic, saying that the police should not be trying to close down community media like this, right? That there are other ways of dealing with that. And George Hislop, who had been one of the major people around CHAT, that kind of more conservative homophile association, had run for city council. And they both lost, right? People had thought that Hislop would be a shoo-in because he was running in kind of the gay, well, we called it the gay ghetto in those days, the gay village area. But he lost, and Sewell lost as well. And so the police felt that we no longer had any kind of political cover, right? Now was their
time to strike.
Community. Now was the time to strike, to settle scores, to like close down this kind of, to close down these baths, right? And it wasn't just the baths they were after. I mean, they also were regularly going into the bars and finding liquor license infractions and, you know, fines and all of that kind of stuff. So they were attempting to close down the whole commercial scene that they saw as a unfortunate development that had come from this bad decision around decriminalization in 69.
Okay, 1996, you received the City of Toronto Award of Merit for your human rights work.
Yeah.
Did that award, did that surprise you?
Yeah, it wasn't 96, it was 98, I believe, right?
According to my research, it says 1996.
Okay. Okay. Well,
it could be 98.
Okay. Anyway, around that same time. Was I surprised? Well, I mean, there was politics behind that as well. It was Kyle Ray, who was city councillor, who had, like, for a long time, gay activist, who actually negotiated that. I remember he phoned me up at work and said, "I'm thinking, what would you think if I nominated you for this city council thing?" And I said, "Well, sure, I guess, if you think it's useful, right? Why not?" So this was the time that the Harris government was in power, a very conservative government. It had amalgamated or was in the process of amalgamating the city, so destroying the old city of Toronto because the city of Toronto was seen as being too progressive. Reef was quite homophobic on the other hand. And so Kyle was trying to set up the city to kind of challenge that provincial government and to have the city take a stand against the homophobia of that government. And so giving an award to a longtime gay activist like myself was therefore politically expedient, I guess, right? And useful because it sort of put the city on record as recognizing the gay community and the struggles around gay rights and the gay community as kind of legitimate struggles that were supported by the city, just as the city was being dismantled and amalgamated into the suburbs by the government. So, I mean, I knew it was coming. It was interesting. It was fun. I remember my little talk, I had like a minute's talk or something to give, and I said it was kind of interesting that to have this kind of recognition, because when I'd started this kind of activism, the only kind of recognition we got was the police kicking down our doors, right? And so this was kind of a nice change, right? And I hope that it does help strengthen the role of the community in the city. So I didn't feel like particularly validated or anything. I mean, I don't look to the state, to validate me. In fact, they were the people who we'd been like struggling against for all these years to get recognition. So it was nice to see that actually happen. And it was nice to see it being able to happen at a point when it could be politically useful in terms of snubbing our nose at a provincial government that was not at all on our side.
So in 2021, how do you see the LGBT community, because you helped to shape this community?
Well,
you personally,
me personally,
those hands and those feet,
yeah,
they worked.
Well, yes, but I think that's why I called the group the book Queer Progress, if you want to do the full circle here. Because there certainly was progress, right? We are a very different community. Our relation to society is very different than it was in the 70s when we were absolutely abject and abhorrent to most people, right? But we're also, as I said before, a much more divided community. That, we can, in a certain way, that old slogan, "We are everywhere," means that we can reflect a demographics of a society as a whole. And so we now live in this society which is much more polarized between rich and poor, much greater disparity on a whole lot of lines. Those class differences are entangled with racial differences, all of those kinds of things. And so on the one hand, I'm appreciative of that progress that we've made. On the other hand, it's been kind of an odd progress because in many ways I fear that it has left us, we're not as strong as we were despite being much bigger and more visible, right?
Have we lost a sense of community?
Well, I think that we're much different now. I mean, the people that make up the community are very different. I had this thought experiment, okay? So they raided the baths in 81 and everybody came out into the streets because we were connected. What would happen if the government decided to close down Grindr and Scruff tomorrow? because that's how people connect nowadays, right? Mm-hmm. Gay men anyway, through those apps and the other ones too. What would happen? Would people come out and protest?
They probably wouldn't know where to go.
Would we know where to go? I mean, I don't know. I mean, so are we vulnerable to attacks in a way that we weren't? We were always vulnerable, but are we as capable of responding now in a way that we were capable in the 80s? I'm not sure. I mean, I put out that question not because I know the answer. I really don't. Maybe. I mean, I was surprised by the response in 1981 as well, right? And so maybe I would be surprised again. But on the other hand, something tells me that you know, it might not work the same way these days.
Provocative thought, Tim McCaskill. Provocative thought.
That's my job.
Who knows? I have to say, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for being on the show. And I know that going forward, you will be contributing to Rainbow Country, and I look forward to that on a monthly basis. Thank you for adding your voice and your knowledge and your wisdom to the show. And I personally want to say thank you for everything that you have done, because we are standing literally on your shoulders, because you and your the people that you worked with and that did all the organizing, you guys changed the LGBT community in Toronto, and I would say across Canada and even beyond. So thank you for that. Thank you for everything that you've done.
Well, thank you. You know, I can't say that it was always fun, but a lot of it was fun, and a lot of it was sex, and, you know, I couldn't think of a better way of spending a life, right?
Oh, my God. Thanks again for your time.
Okay, my pleasure.
By the way, queer progress from homophobia to homonationalism from Tim McCaskill has a rating of 4.8 stars out of 5 on Amazon.ca.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And of course our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So, support. Tune in. Thank you.
Hi, this is Police Constable Danielle Botno, also known as LGBT Cop, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
And with that, this little gay journey through Rainbow Country has come to an end. For the full 2-hour episode where I feature music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house, just head over to marktara.com and hit the archives banner. Don't forget to keep up to date with the show. Follow me on socials at marktara.com/music. The podcast is available on all major platforms, and of course everything is hooked up at marktara.com. Finally, I want to take this time to thank you for taking your time to be with me. Remember, stay well, stay strong, and stay safe. From the 1982 album Shaking the Foundations, and featured in the documentary Track 2, Enough is Enough, which you can see free on YouTube. The song, Endless Night. The band, Canada's very own Rough Train.
Worship of beauty, seduction, release.